Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books and Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Ulvi Bosma. Ulvi Bosma is a senior researcher at the International Institute of Social History and professor of International Comparative Social History at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam. Pardon my pronunciation. He was a visiting professor at the École des Hautes Études in Sciences Sociales in Paris and a fellow at the Netherlands Institute of Advanced Studies. His main fields of interest are the histories of labor, international labor migration, and commodity frontiers. In today's conversation, we are going to talk about his new and very exciting book, The World of Sugar, How the Sweet Stuff Transformed Our Politics, Health, and Environment Over 2,000 Years, which has been recently published in 2023 by the Harvard University Press. Ulvi, I welcome you to this conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today on New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Right. So let me begin by asking you your main motivation behind writing this book. Could you talk a little bit about the context?
Yes, of course, many publications have appeared on sugar, but they're overwhelmingly on the Atlantic realm, on the Caribbean islands, on slave plantations and so forth. I started doing my research on Java, Indonesia, and Java was the second largest sugar exporter after Cuba at the turn of the 20th century. I also did work on India. And I see that when people talk about the global history of sugar, they entirely tend to ignore the immense amounts of sugar that were produced in India, in China, in colonial Indonesia, Queensland, Australia, the Philippines. So I thought it was time to write a truly global history, and I thought that it was well equipped to do that because my background in Asian history. So the reviewers of my book have already said that this is a truly global history, and I think that they are right for a couple of reasons. First of all, I take into account that Asia before 1870 was the largest sugar producer of the world. So most of the world's sugar came from Asia. I'm talking about these sugar plantations and sugar belts and peasant sugar in India and in China extensively in my book. I talk about industrial cane sugar, but also about peasant sugar that was part of the agricultural cycle in India or China or in Latin America. I talk about beet sugar in Europe, and I also talk about how these different realms of sugar production interacted with each other. So I think that that makes it a truly global history of sugar. And of course, it will stir further debates because I know some colleagues are already working on other fields of sugar in Asia. So I hope that we can redress the bias of thinking that sugar is predominantly an Atlantic affair.
Right. And that's very interesting. So could we also say that the history of sugar is the history of capitalism?
Yeah, if we define capitalism as trade and production by private persons, not by government, private persons, for a profit, then I can say that sugar has been very pivotal even in the emergence of global capitalism. So we need to take one step back. About 1,000 years ago, what people did was mostly within their own household. They had their own yards, they produced their own food, Perhaps they bartered within their own village economy, but most of what the people consumed was made by themselves and there was no money involved. Now today, we see that most of what we do is bought on the market, and many of these products are from far away. So there's a tremendous change in our consumption patterns over the past 700 years. And sugar has played a very important role in this. And sugar was one of the first items that was traded over longer distances in significant quantities. Of course, we had spices that were traded over long distances, but that were just in very small quantities. Sugar in the 12th, 13th century was already traded in quite significant quantities, even though, of course, it was not in volumes as it is today. So that is about how capitalism emerged. It's also a telling story about how capitalism functions. Our current overconsumption of sugar is how capitalism functions, how market forces function, the way in which sugar creates social, irresponsible conditions, human oppression, but also the way in which sugar has left the cost of environmental destruction to the communities. We had this week these horrendous news about the fires in Hawaii, and they were on abandoned sugar plantations that were grown or were left fallow after the sugar industry in Hawaii disappeared. And this was an important cause in the devastating consequences of these fires in Hawaii. So the environmental and social consequences of sugar production are also a result of how capitalism works. So the profits are for private persons, but the communities, the society at large, have to foot the bills of the social and ecological consequences.
Right. So could you talk a little bit about how and where did this sugar capitalism begin? If you could also reference to the Indian and the Chinese cases.
Yes, I think that when we talk about global capitalism, and we do that since, the studies by Wallerstein, or Karl Marx even, is usually considered to be a result of European development. Columbus crossed the Atlantic and then brought capitalism to the Americas, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea that capitalism only started with European colonial expansion, and I think that is wrong. It starts earlier, and it starts in India, in China, in Egypt, and in Persia. And precisely because it was so closely linked to the emergence of international sugar trade. So to take one step back, 2,000 years ago, in Bengal, in India, peasants were having some plots of cane, cut the cane, boiled it, and have some chunks of raw sugar with them, which they ate in the wintertime. And that's how the whole sugar economy started. And then in 500-600 after Christ, people discovered how they could make from cane juice a crystalline, gritty sugar. And then in the 12th, 13th century, when Marco Polo and Ibn Battuta, these great explorers, came to India and China, they saw already huge cane fields, and these cane fields were geared to international trade. So in the 12th, 13th century, we see already that urban refiners of sugar come to the countryside, pay advances to peasants to buy their cane. They refine this juice that is made still in the countryside. They pay the farmers for that. The farmers might have people on wage labor. This is where we really see the beginnings of capitalism, and even capitalism that is not confined to a local market, but is already crossing the seas and crossing the mountains into, well, let's say Central Asia, crossing seas from India to the Arab Peninsula and China to along the China coast and to Southeast Asia. So this is really an important moment in the start of global capitalism.
Right. So what is this historical trajectory in which sugar becomes the global south's most valuable export commodity?
Yeah, and not just of the global south, but in the 19th century, European beet sugar industry was also widely exported, also across the Atlantic Ocean to the United States. In the 19th century, sugar was what oil would become in the 20th century, internationally the most traded commodity. But let's just go by one step back in the 17th and 18th century, when sugar was so much traded within Asia, and secondly, of course, when the Atlantic plantation complex emerged. At that time, sugar was already a very important commodity. In the mid-17th century, sugar was the most traded commodity in Amsterdam. That Amsterdam was at that time the main port of Europe. Amsterdam, in fact, actually was what New York is today. But all are indications of the importance of sugar in the development of global trade. Now, we see already in the 17th and 18th century also that sugar is entering the recipes, coming into the household, not yet as a daily commodity, but as a kind of luxury. But sugar consumption is spreading in the 17th and 18th century, not just in Europe, but also in China, for example, or in the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East. In the 19th century, we see rapid urbanization and industrialization in the Western world, and that sugar is reaching then the working classes and becoming a daily consumption issue for the working classes, thanks to the fact also that sugar is becoming rapidly becomes cheaper and cheaper over the course of the 19th century.
Right. Also, how was the price of sugar lowered? How did it become an ordinary item from a luxury one?
Yeah. As I said, of course, a very important factor was the lowering of the sugar prices. So I think sugar prices were reduced by about 80% over the course of the 19th century. And how did it come about? Well, I think one of the reasons was that there were higher yields of sugar per acre. That's because of new plant varieties, because of the application of fertilizer. The introduction of the sugar beet sugar in Europe, which became very soon a very important industry in Europe. The fact that sugar could become so cheap was also due to the continuation of slavery in Cuba, in Brazil, and in southern states of the United States, and the fact that colonial governments allowed a system of contract labor, which was in fact forced labor, allowing hundreds of thousands of contract laborers coming from India, from China, later on from Japan, and from the Philippines to the cane fields, where people worked under forced conditions and against very, very low wages. Technology is also a factor, but less important, because we need to realize that sugar production, that the harvesting of cane of the beet in the 19th century was a very labor-intensive activity. The harvest had to be done manually. So what we see is cheap sugar at the same time and hundreds of thousands of people working in the fields.
Interesting, because I also wanted to ask about the adverse impact of the overproduction and overconsumption of sugar on health.
Yeah, well, sugar consumption and overconsumption is something which is quite recent. In the 1850s, 1860s, obesity because of sugar overconsumption was a problem perhaps for some people of the higher middle classes in England, but most of the people in the world did not suffer from obesity. So this has emerged in the 20th century. And what we see now today is that the World Health Organization has issued a guideline of 20 kilos per capita per year as still a responsible, health-wise responsible intake of sugar. In many European countries, but also other countries in the world, the sugar intake per capita is hovering between 30 and 40 kilograms per year. And in the United States, it's even about 60 kilograms if we include the high fructose corn syrup. So what we see is in fact a wave of obesity throughout the world. And we're also facing diabetes to a catastrophe as a consequence. And the World Health Organization has already declared diabetes 2, a type 2, a pandemic in 1999. And that was not for nothing.
Right. You also mentioned about the cost of production of cheap sugar. So what is the relationship between the producers and the workers in this production of sugar? Is there any connection historically to war and slavery?
Yeah, that connection was, of course, particularly important in the Atlantic realm. So in the 16th and 17th century, when sugar production started, European nations were at war with each other, tried to conquer each other's sugar plantation islands. So there was a lot of violence within the Caribbean region. And of course, slavery itself was a crime against humanity and was attended with a lot of violence. First of all, through the processes of kidnapping and transportation of people from Africa to the New World. And we need to realize that almost two-thirds of all people who survived the transport to the Americas ended up at the sugar plantations. So it is one big story of plantation slavery, of extreme violence and cruelty. We're really black page in human history. Did not stop there. In the 19th century, as I said, we have the regime of contract labor. People were hired, signed a contract, but when they arrived at the plantations, were not free to leave. They had to serve their term at the plantations. And also the coerced conditions in which people had to work allowed the planters to conduct all kinds of violence against their work. So the violence did not stop with the end of slavery. And still today, when we look at Brazil or the western state of India, Maharashtra, or the Dominican Republic, we still see many acts of cruelty and exploitation perpetrated against the cane work. So their whole story of sugar is filled with miserable conditions of workers.
Do you think that the arrival of technology, particularly that of the steam engine, changed the course of history for sugar?
It did not change much in the conditions of the workers, as explained, because the conditions in the field remained the same, because practically all the work in the fields had to be done manually. Cane cutting or the harvesting of the beet was manual work well into the 20th century. But it has changed the character of the sugar industry itself. Before the 19th century, even the plantations, they were highly organized units of production, but they were pre-industrial and they were relatively small, with 200-300 people. Now, through the introduction of steam and steel in the whole process, which happened quite early on in the case of sugar, and we see that, for example, the first railways in Cuba were already there in 1837. So in that respect, the sugar belts were pretty precocious in history in terms of industrialization. But the industrialization was also problematic because it was so extremely expensive and not all planters could afford to buy this equipment. So what happened was that the wealthiest and most strongest planters, they bought the equipment, or as was the case in France or in the Netherlands, that the governments of these nations started to subsidize the introduction of these machines. And all in all, what we see over the 19th century is a tremendous increase in scale. So where we had small plantations with 200 or 300 people in the late 18th century, we have huge plantations with 10,000s of acres of cane land and a huge central factory in the middle of it, drawing its cane from a wide vicinity. So what we see is immense increase in scale, and an increase in scale also in the refinery sector, which is also driven by steam and steel. And what we see in the 19th century is the emergence of big sugar cartels, big sugar conglomerates, highly capitalized sugar conglomerates. And these are still existing today. So in that respect, The technology revolutionized sugar production, and had particularly political repercussions because of the concentration of power within these factories and refineries.
Right. I also have a different sort of a question. Did sugar face any kind of religious condemnation, considering that it was a newer, you know, commodity?
Yeah, it's interesting that sugar was seen as a kind of indulgence. I mean, sweetness is nice, and particularly the Catholic Church saw it as an indulgence. But interestingly enough, for certain Protestant denominations, and let's not forget Islam, sugar became a kind of substitute for alcohol. So where the certain religious denominations forbade alcohol, you see that that sugar was quite accepted. The Quakers, for example, is also a Protestant denomination, rejected alcohol as intoxicating and blurring the mind. But Quakers were in the forefront of making sweets and pastries, chocolate, et cetera, and really consumed them. We had also in England, for example, the teetotalers movement trying to combat alcoholism among proletarians. And they held parties, these teetotalers. And at these parties, there were many sweet cakes and pastries available. So we see a kind of substitution of sugar for alcohol. And that's I think, quite interesting, important facet of the history of sugar.
Right, right. So lastly, could you talk about the history of sugar in America?
Yeah, that's also an interesting story, because the United States, in the course of the 19th century, by the end of the 19th century, were far the largest single sugar market in the world. And I talked a bit about the concentration of the sugar industry over the course of the 19th century. And the United States is a key example of that. We know the stories about the robber barons, the robber capitalism at the Gilded Age in the United States at the end of the 19th century. But that was the time of Rockefeller, etc. But sugar had its own robber barons. And by the end of the 19th century, the East Coast refiners, so the refiners in New York and Boston, etc., decided to form a cartel. And that was because sugar prices were going down. The refiners saw their margins of profits declining. And they decided to form a cartel to operate jointly against their suppliers of sugar, and to raise the sugar prices of the consumers. So that way they were able to raise the margins of profits. So we have a kind of high cartelized capitalism, sugar capitalism in the United States from the late 19th century onwards. And they became even more powerful because it was linked up with the emerging sugar beet industry in the United States, also very powerful. And there's another interesting feature. The United States in 1898 waged a war against Spain, and the consequence of this war was that Cuba and the Philippines and Puerto Rico became dependencies of the United States. All three were sugar-producing countries. In addition, in 1898, Hawaii became annexed by the United States. So all of a sudden, United States, that had always been an importer of sugar, became practically self-sufficient in sugar, and established a very powerful sugar conglomerate with a lot of political clout. And this also led to a system in the United States of tariff walls, and the so-called sugar program, which allowed some client states to export sugar to the United States, but was mainly designed to protect American sugar producers. Now, this was very detrimental to other sugar producers in the world, because protection means that within the country where the sugar is protected, prices are higher than the world market. But outside protective walls, prices will go down because there's some demand falling away. And it became even worse in the 1980s when in the United States, the beverage industries, Coca-Cola and other beverage industries, introduced high fructose corn syrup as ingredient of their beverages. And high fructose corn syrup is not made of cane or beet, but is made of corn. And this sweetness stuff became dominant in the beverage industry, which had tremendously negative effect on the sugar prices worldwide. Sugar industry in the United States is extremely powerful, and it's also very powerful in Europe. And because they are so powerful, they will fight, they will successfully fight attempts by governments to reduce, to follow the guidelines of the World's Health Organization, so to speak, to reduce the sugar intake to levels that are less unhealthy than they are now. So this is our present sugar consumption, and the United States is an excellent example of that. Our present sugar consumption is very much a result of how the sugar economy is organized and how sugar companies and sugar conglomerates actually hold the political scene in their thrall. So it is not that sugar is the result, our sugar consumption is the result because of our liking of sugar. Yes, sure, we do like sugar, but it's also very much a result of how capitalism works. And this capitalism works through a collision of state and enterprise.
Right. So thank you so much, Wilbey, for taking your time to discuss your very fascinating work and new book with us. I hope that our listeners find the podcast interesting and pick up a copy of the book and get to reading it. Thank you so much once again for joining me today.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.